Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is James Petras. It's always great to have Jim back. Jim, before I let you jump in, I've been waiting some days, actually a few weeks, to get the announcement I spotted this morning, and I'll have an article that I'll send to you tomorrow. I'll get it out. Yesterday, the White House, there's so much to talk about, Jim, and I want to let you concentrate on what you're focusing on most, but I just had to mention this because I got what I've been waiting for. I got what I expected. It's that the White House yesterday announced 16 recipients of what's called the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom. Well, you know, it's like the Nobel Peace Prize. Peace advocates need not apply. Well, they're nominated, but they never win. My last Friday's guest, Kathy Kelly, I can't imagine anyone more deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize than Kathy. In days, she's heading back to Afghanistan. She's been there several times before. Going back to the 1990s, she was in Iraq 25 times or more. She's been nominated 3 times for the Nobel Peace Prize. She hasn't won. She'll never win it because she deserves it. Only the Obamas and Kissingers at all are the ones who win the Nobel Peace Prize. Same thing for the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom. 16 recipients, a couple may be worthy, at least to some extent. They have a civil rights advocate on the list. That certainly is something I support, and everyone should. So he's probably someone deserving. But who tops the list? Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, Medal of Freedom. Well, Israel, this past June, awarded Clinton its Medal of Distinction. Who presented the Medal of Distinction? Who presented the award? Shimon Peres, the president. These guys are war criminals. So, one war criminal presented another war criminal with a merit award. Obama, later this year, the date was not announced yet. Obama will present Clinton and 15 others the Medal of Freedom. Clinton's a war criminal multiple times over. He's waged war abroad. He's waged war at home. He ended welfare as we know it. He instituted sink or swim policy. He's responsible for NAFTA. WTO came around on his watch. He was responsible for Rwandan massacres. He continued what Bush 1 started. He ravaged Yugoslavia in 1999. The worst of all was what he did to Iraq. Sanctions. 1.5 million Iraqis murdered by sanctions. Murdered by sanctions. Most of them were children. Children. Genocide. Let's call the award a genocide award. Now that would be a fitting award, except it's not an award. It's a badge of shame. Jim, I had to get that out, and you see my article tomorrow.
You left out one of the most devastating acts that Clinton initiated, Steve, and that was the repeal of the Steagall-Glass regulating banks.
Oh, absolutely.
He allowed banks to engage in large-scale speculation.
It's in my article.
Americans over 10 million loss of housing and millions lost jobs and living standards, and the banks got $1 trillion bailout, and it all comes back to that predator Clinton. So I would add that to the list that I agree with what you've said.
I think
that the damage he's done to the American economy is unprecedented.
He unleashed the tsunami of derivatives, a casino capitalism, and wrecking the economy and the prime mortgage scandal and the rest. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act, Jim, that and repealing Glass-Steagall happened at the very end of his administration. And who was his Treasury Secretary? Larry Summers, the number one candidate for Obama to appoint head of the Federal Reserve. And I have a scathing article on Larry Summers coming. It's all written. I just haven't gotten it out yet.
Yeah, they call him the whale from Cambridge.
Yeah. And they call him a lot more than that. But can you imagine Larry Summers, an absolute arch predator? He's also a woman hater. Harvard hired him as president, and they fired him. I don't think Harvard ever hired a president
before. He also persecuted people that protested against Israel.
Oh, indeed. Well, he enraged the faculty at Harvard, Jim. He disparaged women. He also disparaged African countries. He said they're underpolluted, so we should take all the worst toxins around and we should dump them in African countries. Can you imagine a guy coming out with a policy like this?
And he's called a brilliant economist. The master of depression is called a master. He's called a brilliant economist in the financial pages of the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. I think it's a travesty of any criteria for academic excellence.
It really is, Jim.
Steve, I wanted to mention and start our discussion, our conversation, with what my main next article is on the fabrication of the terror plot by the Obama administration. The idea that there's a global threat based on Islamic terrorist forces getting ready to blow up a new 9/11 kind of activity. And I looked into this, and the source of this is one email conversation that the NSA picked up, which goes on every single day, especially in Yemen, because of the drone bombs. The indignation of all the Muslims reaches a paroxysm, and they always talk about taking retaliation against the U.S., but they took this one conversation and blew it up, and then they passed it on to the media and Congress, and everybody said, look, NSA has discovered a plot, and the plot is a conversation, and Obama then furthered the panic by closing down 19 embassies throughout North Africa and the Middle East on the basis of a conversation. And I think it's an attempt to mobilize the public behind the spy state to discredit the testimony of Snowden and Manning, and to say, look, they are the people that are attacking the NSA, and the NSA is discovering terrorist plots. Now, yesterday's newspapers revealed that in Yemen itself, the terrorist plot amounted to an attempt by some group of Islamists to seize an oil terminal and blow up oil pipelines in a remote region of Yemen. That's what the plot boiled down to. And the fact is that in Yemen every week some group or other tries to blow up oil pipelines. So it's a routine action taking place in a marginal area in an insignificant and poor Arab state. Now, the point is that this is such a crude fabrication based on the most frivolous sources. It would be laughable if it didn't have larger repercussions. And my analysis is, why do they resort? Why does the Obama administration resort to such a bizarre and outrageous kind of fabrication? And I think that the main reason is all the failures. The U.S. Terrorist-backed invasion of Syria is floundering. The terrorists are fighting among themselves and beheading each other. Turkey, the U.S. staunch ally, is in the midst of major public purges and mass protests. Egypt, where the U.S. backed both the military and the conservative Islamists, has fallen apart, and the situation is very unstable. The U.S. Brokered so-called peace negotiations have no credibility because the U.S. has allowed Israel to keep building settlements and purging 40,000 Bedouins and appointed one of Israel's most zealot supporters, Martin Indyk, as the so-called mediator. I mean, there isn't an Israeli land grab that Indyk doesn't support. So there's a general failure, military failure, and incapacity to take serious the new pragmatic peace negotiation office from Iran, the Syrian fiasco, the Palestine fiasco, the Egypt fiasco, the Snowden revelations, the Manning show trial, which has evoked worldwide condemnation. In the face of all these failures and defeats, I think that's the context where they cook up this fabrication to try to justify the spy state in the face of universal condemnation, and to continue as business as usual, to continue wars, to continue spying, to continue to cost the U.S. billions of dollars in war spending and loss and thousands of loss of life.
Well, Jim, I absolutely agree with everything you just said, and I'll add one more thing. Whenever they come out with a terror threat, whether it's a low-level one, mid-level, higher one, the Bush administration did them color-coded from, I believe, red and blue and green, I think, were the lower-level ones, and the highest-level one was red. So Obama, I think it was in 2011, got rid of the color-coding, but the same dirty system continues. And the timing is always key, Jim. They're always strategically timed. All the things you mentioned, I think, come into play on this. And probably the main one was the idea that, you know, NSA is getting its ears boxed. At least the public discussion was opened up. I don't expect much of anything to change, but at least there's a discussion. It's out of the open. It's being discussed, including in Congress, and a lot of people know about this stuff. So you need to divert attention. You need to change the subject. You need to justify the unjustifiable, Jim. So bingo, we get this terror threat. I agree, Jim. I don't know what conversations they picked up. They
well,
may have been real ones.
Steve,
they may
I
even
think
fake
the
ones.
Key point here is the follow up. After 1 week of this terror plot, no one pays attention to it. Anybody? I haven't seen anybody cancel flights. I think the credibility of the threat fell flat. I mean, think of 9/11 when there was an actual terrorist incident. It held on for years. This didn't hold for a week. It's gone from the front pages. It's on the back pages now. Some of the writers are saying, "Hey, look, who are these terrorists? They blow up an oil pipeline every week in Yemen. That's the big terrorist act." Now I'm afraid that given the fact that they're engaged, the Obama administration, in continuing losing wars, multiplying for failures, and unable to distract people with the normal calling wolf, I'm afraid they will actually plan a real terrorist incident in order to convince people that the war on terrorism should continue, the spy agencies should continue, the wars should continue. I think we should be worried about the clandestine operations that the NSA and the CIA can pull off, putting some crazy guy or facilitating some terrorist to get on an airplane or blow up a building and then point their finger and say, this proves that our calls of terrorism, rife terrorism and threats is a reality. And I think we should be very keen to observe the possibility that in desperation they'll engage in some desperate act of terrorism and attribute it to one or another group or countries.
Well, Jim, that's exactly what's on my mind. False flags are a long-standing U.S. tradition. We've had lots of them. And it was some months ago I wrote an article about virtually every single so-called homegrown terror plot was an FBI operation. And the last one that made major headlines was last April in Boston, the Boston bombings. The two brothers charged had absolutely nothing to do with it. It was an FBI / Clarity International plot. Clarity International is a Blackwater-type operation. They were right there at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Clarity people, dressed in pseudo-military uniforms, They were on the side of the street where the bombs went off, and moments before they did, they crossed over to the other side to get out of harm's way. And as soon as the bombs went off, the FBI was there on the spot, and there were photos, a good number of photos, showing Clarity people and FBI together, knowing, hey, we pull off another one, and we'll get these brothers, and they murdered one of the brothers in cold blood, and they're going to put the other one away for life, and he's absolutely innocent. This is the kind of stuff that goes on, Jim. I absolutely expect another false flag, maybe a big one, maybe even one on the level of a 9/11, and 9/11 was homegrown. Well, homegrown, it was state-sponsored terrorism, had nothing to do with the people they charged. I don't know who was on those airplanes, but whatever went on was planned and executed by the government that claims it's supporting us. It sure as hell does not.
Well, I think the main way of operating is to infiltrate some small group and organize the terrorist incident by a plant inside the group, and actually get a group that calls itself Muslim or Islamist or radical to carry out the act. And of course, on the surface, it appears to be an act by a terrorist group. But the background, the facilitators, the organizers, the planners, are these clandestine operations that infiltrate these groups and then organize the act. And then the investigation stops at that level without looking at who was behind the scenes and who benefits from this kind of operation.
Well, there's no question who benefits from it, Jim. We certainly do not. We're the losers. Ordinary
now,
people.
Steve, I want to ask you a question about this affront, this rebuke, Cold War act of Obama refusing to meet with Putin at the G20 meetings in Russia. Is this the start of a new Cold War? Is this kind of belligerency, so crudely put, in regard to U.S.-Russian relations, the bigger picture, is this part of a new posture that the U.S. is striking toward Russia and China? I mean, we know the hostile position the U.S. has taken to Venezuela and the progressive countries of Latin America. Is this part of a global wave of reaction which is being launched at this time? And what are the implications of this attempt to re-engage Russia in a Cold War? We all know that the U.S. refuses to extradite terrorists. There's a guy, Posada Corriles, who blew up an airliner with 76 passengers involved, and he's holed up in Miami. He never was extradited back to Venezuela, where he's charged with mass murder. There are other terrorists that are holed up in the United States. There's one from Bolivia, former president that massacred scores of people during a protest. We could run down the list of Russian Chechen terrorists that are holed up in Washington and in the U.S. U.S. refuses to extradite convicted murderers and terrorists. And yet it complains that Russia won't extradite a single whistleblower. What do you make of all this, Steve?
Well, it's very worrisome, Jim. I honestly don't expect another Cold War. Call it a low-level Cold War, because Russia bashing has been going on a pretty long time. It cooled down during the Medvedev years when he was president. It was there when Putin was president previously. He gave a 2007 speech in Munich with at least one American diplomat, I think a fairly high-level one, in the audience, and he absolutely bashed America diplomatically and justifiably. He bashed U.S. imperialism, and how the diplomat sat through that without gagging and choking, I don't know, but I've quoted from that speech. It's been a while. Well, Putin's president again. He's got some backbone. You can criticize some of his policies, but he's got some backbone. I don't know, Jim, but I suspect and I think and I certainly hope that he's drawn a red line on Syria. I've seen comments. I've put quotes in articles I've written by other Russian officials that Putin is not going to let Syria go down. And if America has the notion of another Libya war against Syria, then Russia is going to get involved in some way. It's going to try to stop it, ideally, before it starts. If this is the case, you never know what can happen, Jim. You can have something low-level. You can have it spin beyond what nobody wants it to get to. So there's a possibility, and I've said it in a number of articles, that we could literally see the whole Middle East explode. And if it does, it'll go beyond the Middle East. There literally is a chance we could see a global war. If that doesn't scare people, I don't know what does. And it's all because of U.S. policy, imperial policy, conspiratorially with Israel, with key NATO allies like Britain, like France, like Germany. These are the people that are threatening world peace and humanity. And Putin is somebody who really wants to do everything possible to prevent the worst from happening. So you never know, Jim. I mean, Obama canceling out of the Moscow summit ahead of the St. Petersburg G20 meeting, I called it temper tantrum politics. Well, that's a light touch to it. It's a lot worse than that. I think Obama, I also wrote it out, I said Obama shot himself in the foot. He made a damn fool out of himself. Countries engage with each other. During the Cold War, as we both know, Jim, there were lots of times there were major, major differences between the Soviet Union and Washington, but they still maintain relations. They still engage with each other. It's over 20 years later. Obama wants to thumb his nose at a major world power? What in the hell is on his mind?
Well, Steve, I think this is a well-taken point. I think the man is both a reactionary and is not altogether have all of his senses. I won't say he's clinically irrational or has mental problems, but he certainly doesn't have a balanced perspective on things. I just want to mention in that regard, for example, right now we have elected in Iran a moderate and pragmatic new president, Rouhani, who offers an olive branch to the U.S. to renegotiate relations. He's put everything on the agenda, on the table. So let's discuss all the issues. We're going to have a nuclear program, but nuclear arms is not part of our agenda. We're willing to discuss. We want a settlement. We want to revive our economy. And lo and behold, Congress votes 420 to try to strangle the Iranian economy, and Obama doesn't take any leadership. Instead, at the same time that Congress passes by 420-20 an Israeli-designed resolution that was written up by the Israeli lobby in the United States and approved by the 52 presidents of the American Jewish organizations. At the same time, Kerry says, I'm open to negotiations with Iran if Iran is willing to recognize the conditions that the UN Council proposes. I mean, what's going on? On the one hand, you want to strangle someone. On the other hand, you want to negotiate with them?
Well, that's exactly right, Jim. Hassan Rouhani just inaugurated last Sunday as Iran's new president. He won a first-round victory in mid-June. He's a very distinguished man. I wrote twice about him. I commented about him on Press TV. He's really somebody that you should go out of your way to engage with. And as far as Iran's nuclear policy goes, well, everybody, U.S. intelligence knows that Iran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful. It's fully compliant with NPT provisions, unlike America, unlike Israel, unlike some other countries, Israel, India, and Pakistan. And Iran's nuclear military agenda is it wants the entire region denuclearized. It wants nuclear weapons abolished. It wants a nuclear weapons-free world. That's the policy of the Iranian government. I can't imagine a more sensible one. It's also a policy advocating peace and stability. This is long-standing Iranian policy. It's got nothing to do with who the head Ayatollah is, or who the president is, or who the top officials are. This is long-standing post-1979 policy. That's the policy of the Iranian government. Is it perfect? No. Is any government perfect? No. But it certainly supports policies that can keep humanity going a long time longer than it will go if U.S.-Israeli-NATO policies get their way in all respects. And Obama, so far, Jim, has not yet recognized Rouhani's legitimacy, nor has he recognized Nicolas Maduro's legitimacy in Venezuela. Again, what in the hell is wrong with this guy?
Well, Steve, I want to raise further this issue. 420 congressmen voted to strangle the Iranian economy. I'm quoting the AIPAC spokesperson that talked about strangling the oil economy of Iran. Now, 420 congressmen, are they all bought by the Israeli lobby? Is it just the campaign contributions? Is it the junkets they're on? Is it that they're too lazy to write their own legislation, that they rely on AIPAC to dot the I's and cross the T's and hand them this? If that's the case, if this vote reflects the power of the pro-Israel lobby in the United States, why isn't it discussed by major pundits, including on progressive websites? Why do they overlook, how did this 420 people vote against the pragmatic and enlightened new elected president in, prime minister in Iran? Why the blindness and why the unwillingness of the U.S. critics of policy to discuss the power of the Israeli lobby in the United States?
Well, indeed, Jim, and you've done such extraordinary writing on the power of Israel in the United States, including your book by that title, and that book brought the two of us together. It's just an extraordinary book. You wrote it a few years ago, but it's every bit as relevant today as when you wrote it, Jim, and I strongly recommend it. The power of Israel in the...
Now, Steve, I want to put an anecdote, if you won't mind, a personal anecdote. Recently, I won't mention the guy, but he's in Chicago. He teaches at DePaul University. He's writing a book about gatekeepers, people that censor U.S. Critics on controversial issues, on particularly mentioned Palestine. And so he included quotes from that book of mine that you mentioned. It goes to the publisher. The publisher likes the book, but he advises him to cut out my references because he says, quote, this will question the seriousness of your book. And the author said, I'm not going to eliminate those quotes. Those quotes are central to the thesis of my book. And then the gloves came off. The publisher said, well, if you won't eliminate these several quotes and citations, I'm afraid I can't publish the book after it had been approved in manuscript form. So the question of censorship related to the power of Israel in the United States is an issue. Now, this writer happened to find another publisher, and he's eventually publishing the book.
Oh,
but that was a courageous act on the part of that academic to pull his book, but how many other people would have backed down?
Oh, a lot of them would have backed down. Jim, we are plumb out of time. I absolutely agree with you. You go nose to nose with the Israeli lobby, and you're playing with fire. I would do exactly what he did, Jim. I know you would do the same thing. The lobby needs to be defeated. AIPAC is the apex of it. AIPAC is a malevolent force. It's also an illegal force. It's an unregistered foreign agent. Jim, many, many thanks. I wish we had more time.
Thanks to you, Steve. Keep up the excellent exposés.
Thank you, Jim. Join us this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.